This is Closing Arguments with Stephen Skirka on In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010.
Hi, good afternoon. I'd like to thank Marcy Siegel for guest hosting for me last week while I attended a wedding in New York City. Well, as we all know, it was 2 weeks ago that the Boston Marathon bombing attack occurred. It left four dead, 265 injured. This week, two men were charged in Canada relating to an alleged terrorist plot to derail a passenger train as it entered Canada from New York City. The allegation is that these two men acted on the direction and guidance of Al-Qaeda in Iran. I'd like to introduce my first guest today on Closing Argument, Daniel Pipes, who's the president of the Middle East Forum. Welcome back to the show, Daniel.
Thank you, Steve.
So, Daniel, you wrote a very interesting article about the aftermath of the Boston Marathon attack, and it was called Education by Murder in Boston. What were the lessons you were trying to draw upon in this article?
My basic point is that as the Islamists engage in violence and other aggressions, Westerners learn and get wiser, smarter, more perceptive about the nature of this threat.
There's a lot of concern in our country that the whole notion of Islamism is branding all Muslims with a bad name, and that it would include moderate Muslims. But you draw a distinction between them, am I right?
I certainly do. And it's also worth noting that Canada is the Western country that has the largest body of anti-Islamist Muslims, most active and most effective. And Toronto, most of all, where you are. It's the capital of Muslim anti-Islamism in the West.
Daniel, you heard me describe the charges this week in Canada. They're only allegations, of course, at this point. But assuming there is an Al-Qaeda connection to this alleged terrorist plot, is that something new that we're confronting in Canada?
Well, there have been a number of incidents, of Islamist incidents in Canada before. No major successes. They've been nipped in the bud. But this one involving Rao Jasser and Shihab Suhair is particularly mysterious. They don't seem to have much in common. We don't really know what the law enforcement authorities know about them. So it's a bit murky at this point.
You wrote in your article that Westerners are waking up to the threat. Wouldn't they have woken up after 9/11? Why do we need the Boston Marathon attack to wake us up?
Well, it's a strange thing because there is no direct correlation between Islamist terrorism and consciousness. For example, there was in New Jersey in February of this year a incident in which an Egyptian Muslim decapitated two Egyptian cops. Got almost no attention. In contrast to Boston Marathon, which led to three and then eventually four deaths, got immense worldwide attention. It seems to me that it's important that the attention paid to these atrocities, or else we can't learn from them. But no, 9/11 was not enough. Clearly, it's 12 years later, and these lessons have not yet been absorbed.
One of the things that we're reading about in relation to the Boston Marathon attack is a potential failure of intelligence, that there was intelligence available that may not have prevented the attack, but certainly would have caused some red lights to go off about these two men. Do you think that there are lessons for the intelligence gathering authorities from recent events in Boston?
Indeed, the more we learn about what happened in Boston, the clearer it becomes that there was a great deal of information. The Russian government wanted them watched. The CIA was concerned about them. But the FBI just shrugged its shoulders and said, no, these people are not of interest. Or this person, the older brother, is not of interest. No, there's a real lapse of law enforcement intelligence and pursuit of a problem.
All right. Well, here's my last question for you, Daniel. Let me play devil's advocate. You moved from 9/11 to the Boston Marathon bombing attack, and as tragic as those two episodes are, they're really the only two incidents of homegrown or terrorism on American soil, and that's over a considerable period of time. So really, aren't we winning the war against the enemy in relation to terrorism?
Your comment reminds me of the front page headline of USA Today the day after the Boston Marathon bombing. It says, "Terror returns," implying, as you just did, that we went nearly 12 years without terror. But I just gave you one example from February of terrorism. I can give you many, many other examples of terrorism in the United States. Perhaps the one that's best known is the Fort Hood attack, which killed 14. But there are many all the time that are not getting attention. Furthermore, there are many more that have been aborted, that where law enforcement was effective and stopped it. So no, between actual terrorist attacks and would-be attacks, there's constant attacks, would-be attacks and attacks in the United States and elsewhere as well.
All right, well, I want to thank you very much, Daniel. I look forward to having you on the show again.
Thank you, Steve. So do I.
All right, let me turn now to my illustrious legal roundtable today. I have Susan Chapman and Marie Hennen back with me again, and I'm really delighted to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to stick with the theme of terrorism, and I want to specifically look at this case involving these two men charged with the VIA Rail passenger plot. And I want to emphasize there's a presumption of innocence, and these are just allegations at this point. But here's my question for you. And Marie, let me pose it to you. Shortly after this incident came to light and the arrests were made, the Harper government introduced some fairly bold provisions relating to counterterrorism. I mean, there's no chance that that's a coincidence. But here's the question I want to ask you. It would seem to me that this plot was thwarted without resort to these counterterrorism measures. Isn't that really an argument that we don't need them, that we're winning the war just using traditional police investigative measures that are already in place?
That's absolutely right, Steve. If you take a look at what the Harper government did, what they did is revitalize or reinstitute the 2007 provisions, which allow the police to detain somebody for up to 3 days to conduct what is effectively an investigative inquiry. In other words, potential witnesses can be detained in the hope that you'll get some information. But take a look at what happened in this case. The information came through Muslim sources, members of the community that knew these people and wanted to cooperate willingly with the police. And often when you look at many of these cases and investigations, really what gets the person that they're looking for is good old-fashioned police work and bridge building with these communities that are willing to provide this information. So I'm not really sure that this legislation, other than getting a lot of headlines, does a whole lot to make us safer.
All right. Well, Sue, when we come back after the break, I want to raise with you some civil liberties concerns about this new legislation. I want you to phone in, those of you listening to this show today, 416-872-1010. You may agree with what we're saying. You may disagree with us, but I do want to hear your views.
You're listening to Closing Arguments with legal analyst Stephen Skirka on News Talk 1010.
And I have with me today Marie Hennen and Sue Chapman. Sue, the Harper government has introduced new counterterrorism legislation, the Combating Terrorism Act. Extraordinary measures, not what we're used to. Now, Marie's made the point it's not effective. But beyond that, what about some civil liberties concerns about this? Are you concerned at all that the police could abuse their powers?
Well, absolutely. And whether it's abuse or not, to hold somebody for 3 days without the right to counsel or any of the other rights associated with that, and for no real good reason, is very concerning. We don't want to become the enemy that we are fighting. And the rule of law is at the foundation of our legal system. And that's something that people are so quick to get rid of in any sort of seeming crisis situation. But those are the times when you really do have to hang on to your basic Canadian justice system values. That we are not like that. We do not detain people without good cause.
Marie, there's this power to compel testimony at an investigative hearing, not for people charged, but for people who are potential witnesses in the case. Well, what if the individual comes and just refuses to testify? How do you compel their testimony?
Well, you can't, or you can hold them in contempt for failing to comply with a court order. But in cases like this, you're absolutely right. In most cases, if they don't want to give the information up, they won't. And if they're going to give the information up, you don't need an investigative hearing to get it. So I go back to my original point. I think Sue's absolutely right about civil liberties, but people have different standards and are resistant to that. My basic problem is I'm not convinced it's effective.
Right. And this case, the rail case, sure, is exhibit number one. There's new offense created as well that really isn't getting much attention. What's right. that, Marie?
That's the offense of either leaving Canada or attempting to leave Canada to commit a terrorism offense. And once again, I'm not really sure how that makes any of us sleep better at night in the fight against terrorism.
I mean, how are you actually going to demonstrate that short of a wiretap, you know, where a person saying, I'm about to leave Canada to, right, you know, to blow up a train in Spain? Where are you going to get evidence to say that's the reason the person is leaving?
Well, that's the danger when measures are enacted in a bit of a reactionary way or under the pressure of certain international events. And this is one of those cases. You're absolutely right. What happens is you make the offenses broader. You catch people you're not intending to catch. And again, you don't make any of us safer.
Sue, I'm really concerned about the rush to legislate here because, of course, this is legislation that wears a big halo. And it's mm-hmm. almost difficult, particularly in light of the Boston Marathon attack mm-hmm. and this Via Rail arrest, for a politician to have the courage to stand up to this legislation and say no.
You're quite right. I mean, it expired in 2007 after the whole 2001. But the government has four times tried to resurrect this legislation. And, of course, they have now the Boston Marathon excuse, that's what I call it, really, to push it through. And most, although there was a significant opposition to it in Parliament, an overwhelming majority did pass the legislation.
Sorry, go ahead.
I can just pick up on Sue's point, because that's absolutely accurate. When this legislation was passed originally, it was in response to 9/11. Notwithstanding, we had obviously terrorist activity in the form of Air India homegrown. And there was no attempt to pass the anti-terrorism legislation. We responded actually to the American experience. And once again, we're doing it.
You think the government, though, is ennobled? And I'll put this to both of you. We're not going to stop here is my concern. This may just be a continuing path we're along. And there'll be more extreme measures to deal with this perceived terrorist threat in the future.
Well, I think every time you get an event like this, which is very compelling and heartbreaking, it gives momentum to enact this type of legislation.
All right. We're going to continue this discussion after the break.
Closing Arguments with lawyer and analyst Stephen Skirka continues on In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010.
Welcome back. Marie Henin, Sue Chapman are my guests on the Legal Roundtable. Today we're going to move from terrorism to cyberbullying. And Sue, let's start with this question. Do we have laws in place to combat cyberbullying right now in this country?
Sure, we do. We have voyeurism in the criminal code, which is either making or distributing sexualized pictures of somebody without their consent. We've got child pornography. And when you look at the case out of Nova Scotia, that girl was 15 years of age. And that would qualify then as child pornography and its distribution. There's the underlying sexual assault. I think we do have the laws in place. It's really better education around the investigations that we need.
Right, Marie. The Harper government, again, has spoken about new legislation to combat cyberbullying, again, with a big halo over it. Nova Scotia, Saskatchewan, provinces that have legislative initiatives to deal with problem of cyberbullying. Let's look at what, for example, Nova Scotia is doing. And let me address with you this question. Is it a Band-Aid or is it useful?
Well, I mean, there's two different things. First of all, the Harper government is proposing to criminalize the conduct, so adding more offenses to the criminal code. And I don't know how we can constantly and repeatedly criminalize virtually every social interaction, but it seems to be the gut response, unfortunately. Now, what the provinces are suggesting, and Nova Scotia with Saskatchewan following are doing, is actually to treat it in a regulatory way, which is sort of interesting. I think there are issues that arise. But what they would do is be allowed to fine someone who engages in certain type of behavior.
Up to $5,000.
Up to $5,000. Parents are held liable for not monitoring their children. And as the mom of young boys, that's awfully frightening. But in any event, the other thing is you can get an order to take the child's phone away or their computers, and you can get a restraining order. If it is an extreme case, they have the jurisdiction to refer it to the police. So those are sort of in-between measures that are somewhat interesting to deal with the cyber community that we live in a bit more creative way. And we have to remember this, that most of the people who are doing this are kids. And criminalizing it is going to bring more kids into the criminal system. And I just simply do not think that that is a correct answer. And it's not responsive to the advancing technology at all.
You know, Sue, I envisage a situation where you have a 15-year-old sending sexual text messages, you know, in a way that he thinks is being provocative, not bullying, and a parent seeing it and saying, oh, no, we're going to get a court protection order for this. And the next thing you know, first of all, the person's cell phone and their tablet's taken away, and then there's a court protection order, and then, you know, right. There's essentially a restraining order in place. Isn't that the concern, where this is where we're going to with these kinds of regulatory protection?
I'm absolutely concerned. But to be clear, that's not to in any way diminish the seriousness of the underlying acts here. I mean, what happened to that girl is nothing short of horrific. But the question is, when you're a hammer, is everything a nail? And that is the reaction. We're going to criminalize all of this range of conduct, whether or not a $5,000 regulatory fine would ever have spoken to the problem in that case at all. Obviously, it wouldn't. But then you're going to have all of this additional group of people under the regulation and monitoring of the state and young people. And really, to what end? So I think it's actually an easy escape for law enforcement to say, gee, we don't have the tools in place. They do have the tools in place. They had the tools in place in this case, and they chose not to do, it would seem, a proper investigation at the outset.
All right. Well, I want to come back after the break, Marie, and I want to ask you if there's any other provision you're aware of where you hold the parent responsible for the conduct of the child, because I'm certainly not aware of it, and I want to know what you think about that. All right.
From local caseloads to the Supreme Court of Canada, this is Closing Arguments with Stephen Skirka on News Talk 1010.
And we're discussing cyberbullying with Sue Chapman and Marie Hennin on the Legal Roundtable. We have Al from North Bay with a comment. Go ahead, Al.
Hi, Stephen. You were just mentioned before your break that you're not aware of any other legislation that makes parents responsible, but I'd like to point you to the Parental Responsibility Act, which is a provincial legislation here. Which deals with mostly if your kids do property damage or something, then the parents can be held legally responsible for that.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Al. I just indicated that I wasn't aware of it, not that it didn't exist, but I can tell you, you have three senior criminal defense lawyers in this room, and all of us weren't aware of it. So thank you for your contribution. But Marie, there still is a concern. I mean, it's a regulatory offense. But the notion that a parent's going to be responsible for a child's sexting, for example, is something that would concern you, wouldn't it?
Well, it would, because it's virtually impossible to police, first of all, and to impose that burden on parents and then the responsibility and liability is quite extraordinary. But Al is right. I mean, there are other areas where parents are held responsible. Civil area, for example, parents can be sued for the conduct of their kids in some circumstances. But to attach criminal or quasi-criminal liability, that's what's extraordinary here.
All right. Well, maybe next time we'll say something good about the Harper government, but today it's an F grade. All right. Let's move to the topic of the niqab. And Sue, you're very familiar with this case because you appeared and argued the case in the Supreme Court of Canada. Am I right about that?
That's right.
And it was that very case that came back to the provincial court judge this week, and he ruled in a sexual assault case that the complainant was required to remove her niqab during the testimony. And this was a preliminary hearing, not a trial.
Right.
Your reaction to the judgment?
Well, I was really disappointed with it. I mean, the Supreme Court of Canada said that there's a complicated balancing of various competing factors, such as her religious rights, her equality rights, and his fair trial rights. And where that balance got drawn when it went back to the same judge in the case to decide was in favor of fair trial rights. But as you point out, it was a preliminary inquiry, which is really a dress rehearsal for a trial, not a trial itself. No findings of credibility can be made in that forum. So there's a pretty limited value to demeanor evidence at a preliminary inquiry, if there's any value at all to it. And so for that reason, I was surprised where he drew the line.
Marie, it's my view that when this matter comes to trial, there is going to be absolutely no issue for the judge to determine that it would be a serious risk to trial fairness to have the complainant wear a niqab. But we're not there now. We're at a preliminary hearing.
Right.
We have the decision of the Supreme Court of Canada. How can it be that demeanor and credibility are important factors for both the judge and lawyers to assess that this particular witness should take off the niqab?
Well, at a preliminary inquiry, you can't make findings of credibility, but certainly credibility is very much a live issue. That's what the focus of cross-examination is in virtually every sexual assault case at a preliminary inquiry. What's interesting, though, is that the Supreme Court of Canada was considering this in the context of a preliminary inquiry, and one of the factors they said has to be considered is trial fairness. So nobody said that trial fairness is non-existent when you're dealing with credibility at a preliminary inquiry. The Supreme Court didn't say that. This judge applied the test. He found that the balance tipped in favor of the fair trial rights. And so, you know, in my view, he applied the test correctly.
But he also spoke about demeanor being important at a preliminary hearing. That can't possibly be true. How is demeanor important at that forum?
Well, it's important to the accused and their counsel to be able to see the person who's making the accusation. And the judge was very much alive to what his limited function is and the impact it had on the defense and the manner they constructed questions in the manner that they responded to the witness. I mean, this is like virtually conducting a cross-examination by telephone when you can't see the person's face.
So if Marie is right, Sue, then why didn't the Supreme Court of Canada say any case where there's credibility, then the niqab is off?
Well, they didn't say that. I mean,
that's
supposed
right.
to be a balancing of factors. And where it was drawn in this case would suggest that in all cases, then, really, it has
right.
to be removed.
Well,
it's hard to imagine one.
Well, I don't think that's right at all. In this case, the judge took into account this woman's evidence, and in particular, her evidence that she would remove her niqab, and one of the circumstances was when she was driving. And so he looked at all of those factors. He balanced it. You may not like where the balance tipped, Sue, but, you know, he balanced the factors and he landed where he did.
When she was driving, but not when she could be seen driving. When she was stopped in traffic, she would put her niqab back on.
Well, when you're driving, you're always seen.
No, but Marie, let's be clear. The genuineness of a religious belief, unlike his initial decision, was upheld in this case.
Absolutely.
So there's no issue about her genuineness, and that satisfied the first test the Supreme Court of Canada went through. It's on, and it seems to me this four-prong test is cumbersome.
Right.
So it really is going to come down to risk of trial fairness, right?
When you say that he found sincerity, that's right. They have a little sincerity hearing at the outset when she has to answer certain questions about, are you serious about this? This is not just some made-up thing. On that hearing, she was permitted to wear a niqab, and the judge specifically notes, gee, none of us had any problems assessing her credibility when she was testifying on the voir dire. But I agree with defense counsel. It's very different when she's going to talk about the intimate details of the offense. Why? They're both credibility assessments. And why is it when it comes to talking about the sexual assault, it's important to address her in that context? And to me, this is sort of the hips don't lie notion of sexual assault, that you got to see her body because it's different than what her words are saying.
But Sue, ultimately, you would agree with me that at a trial, when the jury is considering this witness, the niqab has to be removed invariably under those circumstances. So
actually, I don't agree with
you. Don't
that.
Agree
no,
with that?
No, I don't.
In a contested credibility
no,
case
right.
in front of a jury, that the niqab would not have to be removed?
I would under the Supreme Court of Canada law.
Right.
That's not the position I was urging, obviously.
No. I meant under the present. Of course not. I didn't mean to diminish your position.
No.
Under the present law, that's the case, right?
I think that's probably
so
right.
So the question would be, okay, if she's going to have to do it once, ask rhetorically, what's the big deal if it's twice?
I'd be surprised if defense asked to have it removed at the trial. I mean, that's a different thing. She may be deterred from showing up for trial at the prospect of having to remove it, but will the defense, in fact, ask that she remove that at trial, or will they think it's to their advantage? Because we do live, and we've talked this, you know, already today about terrorism and all this, we do live in a heightened scrutiny of Islamophobia, and so in that regard, they may not even make a request at trial.
Marie, let me raise another concern about this whole niqab case, and that is the overemphasis on the demeanor of witnesses. We have wrongful conviction cases. And I can think of Moran, for example, where demeanor has factored into wrongful convictions. We've overemphasized the way people react, you know, the weird neighbor effect, the way people react on the witness stands. In certain cultures, people look away and don't look at the person asking the question, and somehow that's interpreted wrongly. The person's afraid to answer the question. I mean, isn't there a concern, though, that we're really overemphasizing the importance of demeanor evidence?
Well, those arguments were advanced both at the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court of Canada, and they did not shy away from the fact that demeanor, notwithstanding its flaws and its limitations, still is a valuable consideration in any trial. And indeed, there are numerous cases where adverse inferences are drawn against an accused because of a demeanor. For example, when a complainant runs away crying, that demeanor evidence is always admissible. What you're talking about is demeanor on the stand, and that's very particular. And what you're looking at there is how somebody responds to your questions. And I think that is something that is helpful
but
for a jury.
Let's look at this woman now who has to testify without a niqab. Can't she exhibit nervousness,
sure,
a nervous tic? Not because she isn't a credible witness, because she's exposing her face and she's uncomfortable about it. And the jury may make the wrong finding of credibility based on that demeanor. Isn't there even on the witness stand a concern about demeanor being misinterpreted, Sue?
Absolutely. And for some women, not all, but some niqab-wearing women, that is the functional equivalent of asking me to testify topless in court. It's that big an intrusion to their privacy. How can they then expect to have an appropriate demeanor while testifying to the intimate details of a sexual assault when they've already been compromised religiously and I say in a gender sense at the outset of the trial?
But there are a lot of things that judges can do, and we have that in our law where they can give a caution to the jury and explain certain things about demeanor. We do it with the evidence of children all the time. There's no reason why a judge couldn't do it in this case.
But if the exercise is done in the name of demeanor, then why does she have to pay that price?
All right, well, let's continue this discussion.
From who is liable to will they litigate, the in-depth dialogue continues on Closing Arguments with Stephen Skurka on News Talk 1010.
And we're talking about the niqab decision with Marie Hennin and Sue Chapman on my roundtable today. Marie, I took the position on Canada M this week on national television that not only is this decision not binding on other judges, but I fully expect that other judges confronted with a witness wanting to wear a niqab at a plenary will decide the case very differently than just Wiseman did in this case. Do you agree?
I agree with you 100%. There is nothing binding about it. And remember, it's a balancing exercise, and what that means is a lot of discretion. So I think you're going to find a lot of judges coming to a different conclusion.
That means that theoretically there are other niqab-wearing complainants coming forward. And my number one concern in this area is that this is the only case in Canada that I'm aware of a niqab-wearing woman seeking justice in this sort of case. And we have a critical population of Orthodox Muslims in Toronto. Are these women not reaching out to the police and the justice system for protection? Where are they?
Okay. Well, let's leave the topic on that. Let's move to a interesting story out of China, a wrongful conviction case. And I learned by reading this article in the Washington Post that there's a 99% conviction rate in China and that confessions are routinely extracted from people who are charged through torture. And that's essentially what happened with these two men in this wrongful conviction case. They described being tortured. They spent 10 years in prison, and they won their freedom through DNA. And now, of course, the authorities are conceding that their false confessions were just that, false. Is this just a oneer? I mean, is this something that we're just going to read about once, Sue, and happening in China and never happening again? Or you think maybe the whole Innocence Project movement, the whole wrongful conviction movement is now spread itself internationally?
What I find astounding about this case is how upfront the government in China has been about the reality of this wrongful conviction. I don't think it is at all uncommon. In China, it's routine that the accused is not present at their own trial. The reliance on confessions is lazy and unpredictable, and we can't be too smug in Canada because we have our own areas of wrongful convictions based on false confessions, because the case of Oikle in the Supreme Court of Canada has permitted our police to, for example, lie to accuse people about the state of affairs. And somebody may have been drunk, passed out, not really have much of a recollection of events. They then are filled with lies during the police interview. And this has been proven to result in wrongful conviction. So we have to be careful about that same trend in Canada. But I think it's probably quite common in China.
You know, from my experience, people have a real difficulty, Marie, accepting the fact that people can falsely confess. And as we know, and as Sue's alluded to, it doesn't just happen in circumstances of torture. A good example of that is the Central Park 5 case, just been documented in a movie and book by Ken Burns and his daughter. These weren't young people who were tortured who gave false accounts. These were people who believed they were going to get out that night if they gave those confessions. So this isn't just something that's reflective of the Chinese justice system, but as Sue said, it also comes into our system as well, right, Marie?
I think it does, but let's just draw a distinction here. What they were talking about was being burned with cigarettes, beaten, being subjected to effectively waterboarding. And
this is the Chinese case.
This is the Chinese case. And so that is extraordinary and is ripe for false confessions. And the one thing to note, though, is the acknowledgement by the Chinese government of this is an extraordinary step. And important. And there have been some changes in their criminal system in the past few years as they liaise more with democratic countries. I've had the opportunity to teach there, in fact, and meet their criminal lawyers. So there is some movement. In terms of here, what you're really concerned about, by and large, is this sort of psychological compulsion, which is the Central Park Five. Some very young people who are extremely vulnerable sitting in a room for hours and hours and hours being questioned by very aggressive police officers. And that does result in false confessions. We do know that. And it is very troubling. Unfortunately, we seem to have a higher tolerance for that.
You know,
that's right.
So the question would be, well, why would the police do that? Why would they be interested in extracting false confessions? Why don't they just search for the truth? But there's a reason for that, isn't there?
Well, it's called tunnel vision, and it's called, in the panic, again, of a crisis, everybody's looking to the police to solve the case quickly. What's the fastest way to do that is to get a confession. It's not necessarily malicious in the sense that they're trying to deliberately extract a false confession. They may, in their view of the world, view these people as guilty and as potentially going to get away unless they are able to get that confession. And so that's the much more insidious and commonplace concern.
Robert, quick comment from you. Robert from Toronto.
Thanks very much, Stephen. I can tell you that my experience, and my experience is limited to the criminal law and as it interjects with the family law, that people regularly confess to things just so that they can get off of their bail conditions, which are onerous, which absolutely completely disrupt or destroy their lives. And they say, yeah, I did it, just so that they put an end to that whole process regularly.
All right. Well, Marie, that's the point about trying to end a problem that you think is a quick fix, but it really isn't, right?
That's right. That's right.
Okay. You know, one of the things that I want to ask about this case in China, we're celebrating this, you know, the release of these men after 10 years of being tortured. What's the likelihood they're going to be compensated for that, Marie?
I think slim to none that they're going to get compensation. In fact, what's interesting is they're even afraid to speak to national media or international media for fear of any reprisal. And it's probably a well-placed fear.
Right. I mean, you don't hear their lawyers coming out. And we're not going to see a Central Park 5 equivalent in China, are we, Sue?
There won't be a documentary, I doubt.
No. But, of course, you know, I have to talk about this case in North Korea this week, where a man was arrested as a tourist for taking photographs of homeless children in North Korea, and he's facing the death penalty. Are you aware of that case?
No.
It's extraordinary what happens in the world. So whatever our problems are, I go back to the Harper government. Still much better.
So that, well, there's one government that criminalizes conduct even more than we do, but
yes,
we're close.
We're close. So on that cynical but fair comment, Marie Hennen, I want to thank you. Always a great, robust discussion, Marie Hennen and Sue Chapman. You know, I love you both. And when we return, we're going to have another aspect of the cyberbullying point. The time is now 4:53. I'm Steve Skirka. You're listening to Closing Argument.
Covering the legal landscape in Canada, you're listening to Closing Arguments with criminal defense lawyer Stephen Skirka on News Talk 1010.
And welcome back. Boy, I'm just recovering from that discussion with Sue Chapman and Marie Hennen. That's what happens when you get three criminal lawyers together in a room. That's you don't know what it's like now at a party with criminal defense lawyers. So my guest today is Jana Danziger, and we're going to talk, Jana, about the whole topic of cyberbullying, but from a very different perspective, because you have worked with Toronto schools to provide educational workshops related to bullying. You're the co-founder of an organization called A Different Life. Your background is as an occupational therapist and psychotherapist. And what I want to ask is, you heard the discussion with Sue and Marie about the legislation relating to cyberbullying. Is that the approach that you take? You think we need more laws to deal with it, or do you think there's something else that can be done to combat this problem?
Okay, well, I definitely think that it's a very important step. The legislation is really important because people need to be accountable for their actions, especially when we're looking at cases of cyberbullying where people's lives have been ripped apart. Do I think it's enough? No, I don't necessarily think it's enough. I think we need to look at more preventative approaches. This is a reactive approach to what has happened, these tragedies. And so
the laws are, that's a reactive approach.
Yeah, yeah, the legislation that's come out is
so what education do you think? What educational measures do you think we need?
I think we need to look at how to bring awareness of what happens when people are bullied into the school. So more awareness, more education. And in terms of what happens to someone when they're bullied, from a mental health perspective, it can be devastating for obviously the child, the adolescent that's bullied, and their families. It can rip people apart. So mental health in the school system is something that we're not currently seeing a lot of and that we need to see more of, you know, bringing this coping strategies of how, where can I find resources? How can I deal with the fact that I'm being bullied? And we saw that with Rehtaeh Parsons, her family speaking with Stephen Harper, talking about we just simply did not have the resources, the tools to deal with this, and we didn't know where to turn. And you have to think about that as a very desperate case of someone that was suicidal, not knowing where to turn. I think that the school system has a great opportunity to provide education of this sort to their students in terms of coping skills, strategies. Something that I'm really passionate about, that A Different Life is really passionate about, and something that we're trying to implement in Toronto schools, recognizing that this isn't...
So if there's a teenager like Amanda Taub or Rehtaeh Parsons sitting out there listening right now, who's confronted by this plague of cyberbullying, and it's an extreme form.
Yeah.
Can they contact A Different Life? Is there something they can do right now in a concrete way as a resource to improve their situation?
Well, A Different Life, we do individual counseling. We do that. But our focus really is on prevention and looking at, you know, how can education prevent these tragedies from happening? Once someone is already in dire straits, crisis supports need to be recommended. And we're not a crisis organization, but we would be able to recommend those
crisis
supports.
Okay, so you could connect them to the right person and the right or agency.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Well, Jana, thank you very much for being with me on Closing Argument. And thank you, everyone, for listening and sharing part of your Sunday afternoon with me. I'm Steve Skirka, and you've been listening to Closing Argument.